When it comes to compact construction equipment, Takuchi is a globally trusted brand. The famous red and grey machines you see everywhere are built to perform on any site, delivering power, precision, comfort and reliability from 1 to 15 tons. Now offering a lineup of proven compact track loaders, versatile tool carriers for construction and highways. Choose machines that work as hard as you do. Visit Takuchi-mfg.co.uk to find out more.
It's Wednesday, the 1st of October, 2025, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, in which we review some of the previous fortnight's industry news and hopefully shed some light.
Unlikely.
Bit of a bold claim. Yeah, I was going to say, just as likely to muddy the waters and add to the confusion. But anyway, we'll give it a good shot like we always do. What are we talking about today, Phil?
Well, first of all, Dave, I've got to say you're sounding much better because last time we spoke, you had COVID and you were feeling well rough.
Well, I think it was COVID. I'm pretty sure it was because reading the press stories over the last week or so, there's a couple of new strains of it out there, and I'm pretty sure I had one of them. It started on the first day of my holiday and basically gone by the last day of the holiday. So great timing, absolutely. I've passed it on to my son, so he's looking after it now. So I'm feeling a lot better. Feeling a lot better today, I'm glad to say.
Good. Right, you're asking what we're going to talk about today. Well, we're going to, have a brief discussion about, I think we talked about Heathrow recently on one of these podcasts that we do. Today we're going to talk about Gatwick at probably no great length. I don't think it's too much to say, but it's my nearest airport, so I'm interested. And we're going to have a conversation about piling, I believe.
Yes, that's
the plan.
But
let's start off with what I think is the big government announcement. There'd been actually Labour Party conference. Normally, when you have a party conference, governments, you know, every minister that stands up makes a speech has got some. Today, I announce that we're going to do X, Y, Z, and there are remarkably few of them. But one of the big announcements that came out before the conference, on the eve of the conference, was about new towns. There was a new town commission, was it, that was
New Town Task Force, I think they called it.
Under Sir Michael Lyons, was last year, said, look, we want you to make recommendations of where and how we're going to build these new towns to meet our 1.4, help meet our 1.5 million new homes target. And that report has now been published, the recommendations of the New Towns Task Force, and the government have responded to it, saying that they want to start work on three new towns before the end of the parliament, which is supposed to be 2029. Next election should be due to be, could be earlier, and possibly even more if they can get it.
I think up to 12, wasn't it? Well, 12 potential.
Well, 12 sites have been identified, and the government said, in line with the task force recommendation, saying these are the three locations which are most promising. First thing to do is environmental assessments, and that may muddy the waters, so we may have to sort of shift our focus on, you know, pull in something else from the list of 12. But ideally, we'd like to do, you know, more than just three of the 12. But there's no sense that all 12 are going to start in the next, you know, 4 years.
No
way of that. It's just a list of options. And two things strike me about this. One is, we've been here before, haven't we? I mean,
God, so many times, yeah.
Always talking about new towns. We have had some new towns. I mean, Poundbury, and there's that other one down your way in South Devon somewhere.
That's right, yeah. I can't remember what it's called. They weren't calling that a new town, though. It was a
garden village, is that it?
Oh, something like that. That's the other thing. I suppose it's the same thing, basically.
And North Stone. I read an article about North Stone. It's one in Cambridge, on the edge of Cambridge. Apparently, it's an absolutely dreadful place to live. People moved in with the promise of things, and there's no sort of, you know, laundrettes or post offices or anything that you need to make make a town a town. And the residents who are there, in this particular newspaper article, all seemed pretty miserable and let down by basically, and it seems to be a model of how not to do it. But there's been talk of new towns and remarkable little progress, but the government now saying, no, this is going to be as big as or better than late 1940s post Second World War new town boom that brought us Stevenage and Milton Keynes and,
and
wherever else. There was one in Lancashire, I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, the various other ones. So, yeah, my first reaction was, again, which is why I put the headline, you know, government reboots new town agenda, because it's always been there. It's just sort of been ticking around. But, yeah, we need new towns, nothing seems to much happen. My second thought was that the definition of a new town seems to have rather changed. I mean, if we look at the list of 12 recommended locations, some of them are what you would think of as a new town, whether it's taking a Bedfordshire village, Tempsford, and just making it huge, turning a village into a town.
I think a lot of new towns started like that, didn't they?
Wasn't
Stevenage a village once?
I don't know, probably. I know Milton Keynes are several villages that were sort of merged. And another idea is redevelopment of the former airbase at Hayford Park in Cherwell near Oxford. Hmm. And that would it be a new town, or would it just be another Oxford suburb? I don't know.
Well, I mean, they're also talking about one of these new towns being an extension of Milton Keynes itself.
Well, yes, which is to my mind, is not a new town. The three on the shortlist is an urban development in South Leeds. Now, I mean, in a sense, Leeds is a city made up of lots of towns, you could say. I'm just on the northern side, you know, Pudsey, Carverley, Farsley, you know, Rawdon, Horsforth, Guiseley, Yeadon, the list goes on. All these individual sort of towns, villages, conurbations, but they're basically suburbs. And this idea, you know, the idea of a new suburb being a new town is
stretching the definition.
It's stretching the definition. But it's, to my mind, it seems to be the way to go. I mean, if you've already got, you know, good facilities in Leeds, then it's just making urban areas more dense. Although I've got to be careful what I wish for, because that's what they're doing in my hometown of Maidstone at the moment, or my adopted hometown. But it does seem that it'd be much easier to make something into a place where people would want to live by infilling, if you like, or creating new suburbs in existing places. Another one in this context, they're talking about building out the land at Devonport, around Devonport Naval Base, and densifying Plymouth. And that's a similar sort of thing I'm talking about. I don't think, to my mind, it doesn't sort of satisfy my definition of a new town, but it does seem a sensible way to go, rather than finding a beautiful green field halfway up Great Whernside and just saying, right, we're going to build a town here.
Yeah.
If we build it, let them come, or they will come.
I mean, there is quite a strong lobby in favour of brownfield developments, of course. A lot of people, I saw a big announcement recently, it's probably from somebody like Campaign for the Preservation of Rural England, somebody like that anyway, rather predictably saying, you know, we've got so many thousand hectares of brownfield sites in sort of urban areas throughout the country. We should develop those first. And, I'm sure that a lot of people would agree with that. It does make an awful lot of sense to actually build on derelict land, which is currently not really being productive. But there are, of course, all sorts of practical difficulties with doing that. I mean, first of all, access, infrastructure, contamination of the site, especially if it's an old industrial site. Far easier to cover a nice greenfield site with concrete rather than try and sort of fit something in amongst the existing buildings in an urban location.
I don't know. I mean, I think wherever they decide to target, there's going to be a political outcry. It's going to be, there'll be people who complain and be dismissed as NIMBYs. And I've said before, I don't think there's anything wrong with NIMBYs. They're the great defenders of the landscape and the countryside and so on. And, I mean, predictably, while most of the papers were going, the general tenor of their reporting is, yes, the government's doing something to tackle the housing shortage and this, we need to build more houses. The Daily Telegraph, the organ of choice of the NIMBY, just sort of says it's, oh, you know, outrage, uproar, quoting, you know, people in the Bedfordshire village of Tempsford saying, you know, we don't want any more houses here. We don't want to be turned into a town. Parish Council Chairman of Tempsford quoted as saying that plans were the equivalent of firing a nuke into the village and turning it into a city. This is exactly the sort of opposition that Starmer's going to be facing. And it's predictable, and he knows it, and he's just going to have to, you know, plow on with it. I mean, at the moment, you sort of think the majority he's got, he can do what he wants and survive. But as a lot of political commentators have said ever since the general election last year, his majority is broad but not deep. Mm. The current poll suggests that Labour could be reduced to something like, Adam, was it 90 or 70 MPs or something, I read at the next election on current polling. So, it's a very unsafe, huge majority that he's got.
Yeah, absolutely.
And these new town developments are politically toxic.
Yes.
They may be absolutely needed in the national interest, but whether, how, where they happen, it's going to be not, the decisions will be made not in the national interest, but they'll be made very, very politically.
Oh, yes.
They have to be, otherwise nothing will happen.
So, yeah, I mean, I obviously there will be some people who will welcome plans for new homes, new towns, because we need the homes. And of course, it's an election pledge of the Labour Party that they're going to build all these homes. But as you say, NIMBYs are wherever you want to build, you'll find a NIMBY. And, that also, that environment, it also houses voters. So, you know, if you're going to alienate people locally, you're going to lose their votes as well. So he's got to be careful where he builds.
Just pick Tory seats.
Yes. safe Tory seats. Yeah.
But we had so many emails after the government announcement from all the industry talking heads saying, you know, this is what they need to do. This is how they, you know, these are the lessons of the past that need to be learned. And I thought it might be interesting to just go through a few of them. And typically, they're completely, you know, contrasting. Patrick Clark, Master Planning Lead at ACOM, says, the real challenge would be delivering them at pace. You need to be at pace, you know.
Yes.
New towns will fail to deliver in isolation from the neighbouring communities and just consider plots of home. But you've got to do things quickly. Lord Gascoigne, the chair of the House of Lords Built Environment Committee, his focus is on, must be done the highest standards. We don't want, you know, cheap snot and cardboard things going up. It's got to be really quality stuff. It's got to be nice. Places where people, you know, visionary house building, places where people want to live. A few people say it can't be copy and paste across the, you know, the prison building, for example, is being, or prison expansion, is being driven by, say with the hospital programme, very much a cut and paste model, to, you know, reduce cost, standardised design, same with school being. We've got off-the-shelf designs, plonk. There's your new prison block. There's your new hospital.
Yeah,
absolutely works. New towns, no. We don't want, you know, just... which, I mean, effectively, what we would have had if all these modular home-building factories that we've, you know, talked about in the past, have now shut down. If they'd been churning out these Lego houses and just plonk them around the place, it would be cookie cutter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you wouldn't have any regional variation.
Lots of people talking about the importance of getting the infrastructure there, and not just talking about water and sewerage and roads and public transport, but even things like one person saying, logistics facilities, next day delivery depots, so that you've actually got beyond the what we think of, but the full social and business infrastructure it needs to be in place ahead of time. Otherwise, you'll end up with the, you know, the North Stow scenario where it's just like a dead dormitory.
I don't think we should hold our breath to see what actually happens. They might put spades in the ground on three sites, maybe. Within the next 4 years, but I don't think we're going to see. I mean, judging by previous record so far. I don't think we're going to see widespread new town development springing up around us within the next 5 years or 4 years.
It sort of leads on to the next topic we're going to talk about, Gatwick Airport. Maybe it's just my cynicism kicking in as I get older, but there seems to be... it doesn't matter what government... Governments always want to be seen to be doing things.
Yeah.
So they say, you know, go back to Heseltine village of the Lower Thames Corridor and that sort of thing. It's always saying, yes, this is our vision, we're going to do this. And Starmer's had a lot of bad press for not conveying a vision. So I have no problem with the vision thing. But they keep announcing, we've seen the past year, the government made a lot of announcements about infrastructure, you know, policies and build, but not yet much action. I suppose it's only a year on, it takes a long time for these things to happen. But a lot of these announcements, especially including new towns, especially including, and we talked about Heathrow the other week, mm-hmm. they're just things which just keep re-announcing, you know, things that come out, back in the long grass, you know, bring it back to life, put it back in the long grass, bring it back to life. And without much, it seems to take an awful long time. And it's not necessarily the faults of government. I'm thinking that if we talk about, go onto airports, it seems to be every decade, there's basically a kick in the nuts that screws the whole thing up. You know, 9/11 in 2001, and then a little less than 10 years later, no one wanted to fly anywhere after that.
No.
And then, you know, 2007, 2009, global economic crash. No one could afford to fly anywhere. Nothing happened. Another 10 years later, COVID comes along. No one can go anywhere. No one wants to go anywhere. And certainly no one wants to sit on an aeroplane. So every 10 years, something just like, whether it's the economy generally or airports, demand for air travel, just sort of not. It gets a kick back. And then the kickback sort of recedes and people start flying again to talk specifically about airports. And then we start saying, OK, it's all back on the agenda. Everything we've been talking about for the past 30 years, it's back on the agenda until the next busted thing happens.
We've only got 4 years until the next disaster.
Yeah.
But
so anyway, Gatwick is back on the agenda. We said that, as I said before, that Heathrow expansion has got development consent. Gatwick has now got development consent for its expansion. It's not on the same scale as Heathrow, but it's still significant. It's a £2.2 billion shovel-ready, privately financed project. No cost to taxpayer, ready to go, bosh. It's ready to go, but I don't quite know when. There's no sign of exactly when they're going to start digging or who's going to do the... I'm sure Vinci will be first in line to do a lot of the work.
They own it, don't they?
They own it, or they're the biggest shareholder. I don't know if they own a majority of it, but I think they're the biggest shareholder. And it's... In terms of Heathrow, it's actually quite a modest thing. They've already got a second runway, but that's on sort of for standby and emergency use. And it would just be bringing it into regular active use, which requires relocating it 12 metres to the north. Now, that doesn't mean sort of cutting off one end and moving the end. It means that the whole thing sideways.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's going to be, yeah. So it's laying a new runway where the site's already there. It's, you know, doesn't involve knocking down any houses or any possibly purchase orders or anything like that. It's all politically and technically, I think, relatively straightforward. But an awful lot of development around the airport itself, expanding.
Well, because of the capacity increasing.
Terminals,
yeah.
Car parking, offices, hotels, and all of this stuff. So it's yeah. I mean, obviously, there's going to be an appeal. Someone's going to lodge an appeal and say, oh, we don't like it.
Well, the people of Surrey probably aren't going to like it because it's going to increase traffic, traffic.
Yeah, and road traffic as well, I guess.
Yes, yeah.
So when it actually starts... Oh, I've just got in front of me. Vinci do own a majority. They've got 50.01% of it.
There we are.
So, yeah, when all the legal stuff, town just get sorted out and... I don't know when spades will be in the ground. I'm not even sure whether the Gatwick have said themselves when they hope to start digging. But it's if you're not in the local area, it's hard to see anything but good in these plans.
It certainly seems to have far more going for it than, say, the Heathrow plan. I know that they're not of the same sort of scale, but it's quite a simple solution and could be quite easily done, and it's not going to cost the taxpayer anything. So, you know, what's not to like, sort of thing? Only if you're not in the area. Only if you are in the area would you object.
Well, broadly, except an awful lot of, you know, Greta Thunberg types who will go, oh, no, we don't like aeroplanes. Mm.
Oh yeah, but they're going to be net zero aeroplanes by the time this happens. So, well, that's what, you know, people are saying. They're talking about, you know, sort of very low carbon emissions from aircraft. I don't believe it myself, but certainly people are working on it. So emissions will come down, but yeah, it's going to be a net increase, isn't it?
So that will be the basis, I think, of the legal challenge. It will be that it's not compatible with the government's net zero by 20 whenever.
Yeah. You know, nothing is, though, Phil. Nothing is.
Very little. Yeah.
Mm. I have to say that it wasn't on my radar, this Gatwick expansion. I think probably because there was so much noise around the Heathrow proposals. I mean, first of all, we had Boris Johnson, whose constituency sort of is alongside or actually on the Heathrow site. He was promising to lay down in front of the bulldozers, wasn't he, to stop it until he became Prime Minister, in which case, at which point his attitude changed somewhat. But there's a lot of talk about it for many years, and it seems to me as if Gatwick had very quietly been sort of working towards his plan without making too much fuss about it. I guess it's just less controversial, so there probably was an awful lot less talk about it.
Yes, I haven't heard what the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, had to say about it, but he's also a spanner in the works of anything to do with fumes.
That's true.
He's very sensitive to the whole fumes and emissions issue. But of course, Gatwick is, I think Heathrow is within a London borough, but Gatwick is outside London.
Yeah.
It's outside of his bailiwick, so, even though it's a, you know, a London airport.
Well, we'll see. But we won't see soon, I don't think.
No, sadly. Right, well, we're ticking things off quite quickly here.
We are. Let's talk about piles.
Yes.
I'm not talking about hemorrhoids, and this is something far more palatable. Yeah, a story that you ran this week, I think on Monday, actually, about an implausible number of concrete piles being installed on a site in Somerset. Tell us a bit about it.
Well, the report came from a company called National Pile Croppers, who, as the name suggests, they supply equipment and service to crop off the top of piles.
Hmm.
And they send quite a lot of stuff. And normally says, we crop some piles. But of course you do, that's your job. And I don't often use the material they send in. But this, the Agritas battery factory, electric vehicle battery factory, that's underway in Bridgewater in Somerset. Agritas is the battery division of Tata. Tata, the big Indian steel company. It's also the parent company of Jaguar Land Rover. And the idea is that, well, not that Jaguar Land Rover's been doing much lately with the problems they've had, but separate story. But they reckon that by supplying Range Rover and Jaguar and Land Rover cars and competitors as well with electric batteries, this factory in Somerset will be supplying 40% of the UK domestic electric vehicle market by the end of 2027. That's not far away, so it's going to be up and running. At the moment, it's just putting in the foundations. Now, this is a big factory. Building one is set to cover something like 250,000 square meters. So that's a big building.
Yes.
And under this building, oh, I don't know if the piles are just for this building or they're for future stages as well. So it might be for other buildings as well. But the point is, on this site, 17,000 piles that have been sunk. And I thought, wow, that's a lot. We should write about it. Any project's got 17,000 piles going, that should be talking about this. That just seemed like... And it's only after I'd run it, I thought, hang on a minute. That must be some kind of record. So I went into Google, what's the most piles under a building ever in the UK? And it answered all sorts of questions which I hadn't asked. It said the heaviest load test on piles somewhere. And of course, Google doesn't come up. What now happened, instead of getting lots of Google responses, the first thing that comes up when you put something into Google is AI overview. So AI overview. And I said, most piles under a UK building. Typically, it didn't answer the question I asked. It said, the Shard in London likely holds the record for the most piles under a single UK building, with 166 load-bearing piles installed for its 87-storey structure. Now, 166 under the Shard. Well, the Shard has not got a footprint of 250,000 square metres. I don't know what it is, but it's a fraction of that. And 166, for building of the footprint of the Shard, it's probably a lot. But it ain't 17,000. No. So and he says, AI continues, while smaller buildings might have a few dozen piles, large skyscrapers require more. AI, thank you. Anyway, Balfour Beatty had the contract for piling the Shard, and that was a £14 million contract, which, a quick bit of math, works out at £84,000 per pile, if my maths are right. And on that basis, if it's £84,000 per pile, it means that Agritas are paying £1.4 billion just for the piling. And I don't think that's happening.
No. Well, it's a different sort of pile, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
The ones under absolutely. The Shard will be big board piles, probably of about 1.5 to 2 metres diameter, some of them.
And very deep.
Yeah, and very deep. Whereas the ones under this Agritas building... By the way, thanks for pronouncing Agritas, because I didn't know how to pronounce it. Was it Agratus, Agratus, or Agritas? But we'll stick with Agritas. It sounds a lot better. Yeah, well, I mean, these are small piles. These are precast concrete piles. And in fact, I got in touch with Balfour Beatty Ground Engineering, the company that did them. And I spoke to one of their people, Mark Pennington, who was obviously deeply involved with this. It's fascinating because, that's an awful lot of piles, but he said it might... He was careful not to say that it was a record. He said it might be a record, but he doesn't know. We've done some other big factories recently with similar numbers of piles underneath them, but this might be the biggest. So it could be a record, we just don't know. Nobody's actually done the maths on that. But these 17,000 piles were all manufactured by Balfour Beatty Ground Engineering at their factory in Grantham. Bottisford, I think, is where it actually is. I didn't know that they had a pile factory there. But yeah, they've made these precast piles up in Lincolnshire and then shipped them down to Somerset for installation. Obviously, they've done it on a sort of just-in-time basis. So basically, he said, according to Mark Pennington, they've made sure that they've had about 2 weeks' worth of piles on site at any one time. So sort of phased deliveries. But you can get between 12 and 15 of these piles on a single lorry. So assuming the maximum 15, that's about... I did do the maths.
More than 1,000 lorries then, isn't it?
Yeah, about 1,300 lorry movements to get these piles there. Over a period of about 12 months, it has to be said.
And they're not getting anything back on the way back, are they? It's a one-way trip. You can't... It's not like proper logistics.
Know.
You take something one way and take something home with you again, so you're productive in both directions, but I can't imagine they're doing that.
No, what would they be bringing back from Somerset? I don't know, turnips maybe or something like that. No, they probably grow more turnips in Lincolnshire than they do in Somerset. interesting. But so thousands and thousands, over 1,000, almost 1,500 lorry movements to get those. And the reason, because... a big factory like this, it's very wide. It's spread out. It's not high. It's not like the Shard. It's the opposite of the Shard. Big footprint, but relatively low rise. So it's what, two, three stories, probably. But he said there were some, because it's a factory, it's got equipment in it, probably fairly big equipment. Some of the loadings were quite heavy for this building, apparently. And I know Bridgewater, it's probably, is that on the Somerset levels? It's probably very alluvial soil. He said the soil wasn't very good anyway. So rather than just put down a big concrete slab, they do have a big concrete slab. There will be a big concrete slab here. But you can't just put a raft on top of this soil. You've got to provide it with some support. So that's why they've had to put all these piles in there and then break the caps off them, break the tops off the caps, and then cast a concrete raft over the top of those with the piles supporting it. And the piles, I think the National Pile Croppers went into quite a lot of detail about the equipment that they're using there, including a very compact model. I can't remember which one it was. But apparently some of these piles are situated very close together, so you can't get a big old hydraulic pile cropper in there. They've had to use a very compact one. Yeah, from a civil engineering point of view, I think you've got to be very interested in piling. But it's interesting if you are interested in piling. Big job over a big area.
It just seems huge. And I think a reference for older listeners, sort of bring Cyril Fletcher into it. Remember Cyril Fletcher?
Well, I recognise the name.
Who then says, "We think it's the biggest, unless you know better or you know different."
Right, okay. So yeah, challenge.
If anyone can tell us any construction site, and I'm not talking about HS2, because that's not a site, that's lots and lots of different sites. Yeah. Any single building, let's say, either in the UK or elsewhere in the world, that has had more than 17,000 piles underneath it, we want to hear about it.
Yeah.
Because
we
think this is very probably a record.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So we'll wait and see. Hopefully somebody will let us know. Talking about people letting us know, Phil, can I mention something else? I was contacted this week by a disappointed reader.
Just the one?
Just the one, although he said he was probably one of hundreds. But I'm glad to say, if he's listening, that he was not one of hundreds. A chap called Tom Fox. I don't know who he is, don't know where he comes from or what he does, but he might be a health and safety specialist. He might just be a construction industry worker who cares about health and safety. But in any case, that was his concern. We published in the September issue of the magazine, which has been out for a couple of weeks now, an article about microgrids. You know, basically small electricity grids serving local areas. That wasn't the issue here. What was the issue was a photograph.
His
issue was a photograph which accompanied it. I'll read you his email because it's quite short. But rather than try and describe his concern, I'll actually give you what he said. He said, "I was surprised and disappointed that you allowed the attached picture on page 53 to be included in your September issue of the Construction Index. It is nearly always easy to find some safety fault in a photograph in the construction press, but this picture had so many faults, it just had to be challenged. No edge protection, working off a ladder which doesn't even appear to extend sufficiently above the gutter, working in trainers and operatives balancing on panel supports, to name just a few. Maybe I am the 101st to comment, and you have already had 100 comments on the same theme. I hope so. Maybe the image was generated by AI. However it was produced, there is no excuse for publishing it and showing the construction industry in the worst possible light. Hopefully in your next edition you will publish an apology to the industry." Well,
you should describe the picture, David, as well.
Yeah. All right, we'll consider this to be the apology. I'm not going to put anything in the magazine. The picture shows, it's taken obviously by a drone, looking down
vertically.
It's a bird's
eye view, isn't it?
A bird's eye view, looking down on a roof. And in fact, while I'm talking, I will bring it up so I can actually
I've got it in front of me. I'll take
have
it.
You? Yeah, all right, go on.
It's two people placing a solar panel onto the roof of a building.
Pitched roof.
A pitched roof of a building. You can see beneath them the ladder.
Yeah.
And Tom Fox is quite right. There's no edge protection. It's not entirely clear they're wearing trainers. They've got white footwear on. They could be white safety yeah. footwear.
Probably trainers.
And they're wearing company-approved overalls, matching overalls and matching shirts. And they're both wearing hard hats. Both wearing hard hats. So if they do fall two stories to the ground, yep, they've got their hard hats on. But there's no—he's right. There's no harnesses or anything like that. But I would say, judging from the architecture and the style of the hard hat, this looks suspiciously foreign to me.
Yeah.
Middle European, maybe. And you say the picture is supplied by...
Well, this is the thing. Now, let me just explain that there's a certain amount of laziness involved here in that I was supplied this picture, along with two others, which also accompanied the article, by a PR firm who sent in a press release on behalf of a building services consultant called White Code, I believe, who located near you, actually, in Gravesend in Kent. They sent me something about microgrids, and that provided the genesis for the article, actually. And so I used the photographs which they had sent. Did I notice that there were all these safety errors in the photograph when I put it on the page? No, I didn't. I didn't. If I'd thought about it, I probably would have realised that, yeah, there's no scaffolding, et cetera, et cetera. But so I used the photograph. And so, mea culpa, I shouldn't have done. I should have gone and found something and, you know, bought a photograph online from an agency or somebody like that.
No, this has long been an argument. You and I have both been at this game a very long time in the construction trade press. Probably 70 years between us, 60 years between us in the construction trade press. And I haven't had one of these letters for a while, but regularly, it's a regular thing. And the debate is, should the construction trade press run photos like this? And I'm sufficiently old school journalist to say that there's an element of supporting the industry and standing up for the industry, but our job is journalism. It's to report. It's to... Now, this is a PR pitch. It's not really. We're not really saying, you know, we went to this construction site, we're writing about this construction site, and we are showing what's going on this construction site. So that would be a different thing. The fact it's just the theme pick, maybe there's some obligation to show good practice. But if I go write a report about, you know, a building going up, and I hide away from... reporting or showing the truth, whether you know, with visuals or words, you're not doing your job as a journalist. And I don't think it's a journalist's job. It's a PR's job to make sure that the public relations and the image and the messaging is all on brand and on message or whatever. If anything, it's a journalist's job to cut through that and to see beyond that and say, this is what it's really happening. And I don't believe this is a staged photo that you put in the magazine. I think it was an actual job that's going on, and it was going on in this way. As I say, I don't think it's in the UK. Let's hope that higher standards are observed regularly and routinely in the UK. But if this is what they do in wherever it may be, whatever country it may be, this is what they do. This is how they do it.
Yeah.
We're not lying.
No, this is true. I don't know. I don't know where this site was. As you said, it does look a bit continental to me, but I don't want to cast aspersions across the channel. But I did do a reverse search on the picture, a Google search, and this picture has appeared everywhere. Not just this picture, but other pictures taken at the same time, a whole sequence of photographs of this particular job being done. EU.com, I don't know who EU.com are, but these are some of the people: Limerick Chamber, India Mart, Econ Solar Engineering, Monza Installs, Recycling International, Luminosity Solar, Lightspeed Solar, but then a lot, because this is obviously held by...
It'd be an agency pick then. Yeah,
Shutterstock, Alamy, Vistaprint... but then Solar Dynamics Limited, Texas Best Solar, Watson's Building Services, Powerline Magazine, Paper Jam, whatever that is. You know, they've been everywhere. Even saga.co.uk have used this picture. So, you know, it's... The thing is that we are one of many who have committed this offence of showing the industry in its worst.
But I think Tom Fox's point is that we should know better because we are the construction trade press. Yeah. We're not Saga, we're not Paper Jam, wherever they are. You know, we're the construction index and we should be showing best practice.
Mm.
And I think, yes, we should, if we're talking about best practice, we should show best practice. But if we're talking about a particular project, which actually we weren't in this context, it's just an illustrative theme picture. But if we are talking about a particular project and showing photos of what's happening on a particular site, if that's what they're doing, that's what they're doing.
Yeah, that's true. And I think probably you're right. If we're talking about a specific project and we see something which is perhaps not best practice, we're duty-bound to report that and show it. If we're talking about best practice, well, we're duty-bound to show best practice unless we want to show people what best practice doesn't look like. I think on this, in this example, I would have chosen a photograph, an alternative photograph. I mean, I haven't got any on my own picture library that I've accumulated over many years. I would have had to go to one of the picture libraries, one of the agencies, to get a photograph, but I would have chosen one which looked a little bit more best practice compliant, if you like. But I think probably when I was putting it on the page, I was looking at the image. And it is a good image. It looks nice. You know, it looks like quite a good picture. So I didn't have my construction industry commentary hat on at the time. But I mean, I'm just making excuses for myself. You know, Tom Fox has a point, and I take his point. You know, it is a shame that these things happen, but I don't take personal responsibility for depicting it.
But there's one news outlet in the construction space, specifically Cranes and Access, vertical.net, I think it is, which makes has a regular feature of showing bad practice.
Does it? Okay.
Death Wish series, and regularly, monthly, if not more often. And a lot of them are famous tropes with, like, three ladders tied together and someone cantilevered off and or whatever. Or, you know, people working from excavator buckets to get up high or something.
Which is a common one.
And they did this. And that, I suppose their audience is the powered access world, you know, nationwide platforms and whatever. And so for them, in a sense, they're providing a service to their customers who can say, look at all this bad practice. This is where you should be using a scissor lift or a boom lift or a Bronto or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're not. It's a death wish. These people are going to die. And they talk about Darwinian natural selection. The stupid shall die.
Yes, exactly. But as you said, you know, this happens all the time, and you and I both get regular press releases from the health and safety executive about people being prosecuted for causing injury and death. I think if a lot of our readers actually saw the amount of information we had from the HSE about these prosecutions, they'd be horrified, because people being maimed and killed in the most horrific accidents on construction sites around the country, usually, not always, but very often, small companies, small organisations, small sites, just cutting corners and doing things the wrong way.
I would argue, actually, yes, that I would agree that more often than not, small companies are the ones being prosecuted for health and safety offences. But I would argue that that is not disproportionate to the ratio of small sites, big sites in the country, you know, small companies and big companies.
Yeah.
That your big top 10 tier one contractors, on a per site basis, are probably just as culpable as your little mom and pop startups, or I don't mean startups, but you know, your little local builder doing an extension to a home or something. That yes, it's the, I mean, there's one, someone was killed from falling 6 feet.
Yeah.
Or eight feet, just off a little platform, putting a sign above a shop. Hurt the head and died in hospital a couple of weeks later or something. Mm. So it's a dangerous industry. We know that. And I think that the big companies go to, you know, all companies go to an awful lot of lengths to maintain safety, but yeah, a lot of accidents happen.
Yeah,
if we know.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, I have been, and I'm sure this has happened to you before, when I've actually gone out on site to see a project underway and taken photographs myself for the article, and then subsequently been contacted by the PR firm or the contractor involved saying, we need to see your photographs before you use them. And I certainly bridle at that, because if I've taken inadvertently or deliberately a photograph which shows some sort of unsafe practice which could get them into trouble, that's on them. That's not on me, you know. And what they're asking me to do is cover up for them, or allow them to cover up by editing the photographs or you know, refusing to let me use a particular photograph. So I've never agreed to that.
My advice to any construction company or their marketing people, PR people, is yes, invite journalists onto your site and say, don't bother taking pictures. We've got a professional photographer we'll pay for, we'll cover the costs, and we'll get really, you know, shit-hot photos. We'll take them for you and we'll supply them for you. You just say what we want to put, you know, if you're anything you want to point the camera at, we'll do that. And then they're in control of the photography process.
Yes.
It looks like they're doing a favour, rather than saying, you know, we're banning you from reporting something. We're gagging the press.
That's better for all, for everybody all around, I think.
Yes, women all the way around.
And in fact, one final comment that I would make about this is that I get an awful lot of really crap photographs from PR people. And very often it's, they can't do anything about it because that's what their client has provided them with. But it's astonishing how some people think that a blurry, muddy picture taken... I mean, you can take a bloody good photograph with a smartphone these days. I've used smartphone photographs on the front cover of the magazine. There's no excuse for sending in crappy photographs which are badly framed and out of focus and underexposed or whatever, but we get them every week, all the time.
Steven Soderbergh made an entire movie on an iPhone.
Did he? Well, there we are.
Can't remember which one it was, but...
You can do it. You can do it.
You mentioned stuff you get from PRs. This one. Sometimes you can just sense that it's not the PRs. It's getting, or even the, you know, marketing people. Whatever. It's getting client approvals. If you're down the supply chain, whether that's or internally down the pecking order or whatever, trying to get things signed off and approved to send out to the trade press. Case in point, 30th of September, I had this from someone representing Marley, the roofing tile people.
Yeah.
Is it Marley? Hang on.
Yeah, I think it was Marley. I think if it's the one I'm thinking of.
Yes, Marley, beg your pardon. Anyway, so it says, good afternoon. This is 30th of September. With temperatures set to rise again, staying safe in the sun isn't just a summer issue.
They've been waiting since May to send that out.
Yeah. I don't know. They've been offering advice and practical support to help protect roofers as the temperatures soar.
Hmm.
Marley's annual Safe in the Sun campaign has been helping raise awareness.
Yeah.
That's
a real shame. A lot of work has gone into that. A lot of work's gone into it. It's wasted.
The one that actually disappointed me was a company called Modulift, who do lifting gear, spreader beams.
Yeah.
They sent me some really good pictures, actually, an interesting piece about the technical work they'd done. Modulift engineered and manufactured a modular 38-ton custom rebar lifting frame for Hinkley Point C, for the one of the big lifts of what's the big crane called? Big Carl.
Yeah.
Lifting on the dome, the dome of the
reactor
building. And I thought, oh, you know, interesting bit of engineering detail behind this. But I thought, hang on a minute, I remember writing about this. Turned out it happened 2 months ago. Is it 2 months? And say, so if we report in whenever it was, July, that this big lift had happened, we're not going to want to report 2 months later, oh, remember that lift you were telling you about? Here's a bit more detail. So it was a shame. I would, you know, if it had come promptly and timely. I would have very much liked to use that. And again, that's not modular fault. That's trying to get
approval from all the various people up the supply chain.
Everyone involved. So that was a shame.
Yeah, but yeah, that's a problem.
Anyway, by and large, we very much appreciate and value all the material that we get sent, whether it's news stories, leads, photographs, material, stuff that we're talking about from National Pile Coppers about this site with 17,000 piles. Is it a record, people? Please tell me if you know any site that's got more. And if you want to talk about anything else or want to join in the conversation, that rather implies we can X us or tweet us and we'll join in and talk to you. No, we don't do that. But you can email us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. And David and I would love to hear from everyone. But for another episode, David, are we done?
I think that's it, Phil, yeah.
Great stuff. All right, thank you very much. See you next time.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.